When you picture an apex predator, like out in the wild, say a black panther or a lion, your brain instantly cues up this very specific visual script. You expect exposed teeth, you expect unsheathed claws.
Right, explosive action, just total visual chaos.
Exactly, this rippling muscular tension that practically screams an imminent hunt. Biologically speaking, when we think of a beast like that, our nervous system just braces for total chaos.
It's a survival mechanism, really. I mean, human beings are evolutionarily hardwired to seek out that exact level of visual drama.
Right.
When we look at a dangerous animal, our brains are basically begging for a clear sign of unleashed aggression. We need to see the threat moving or, at least preparing to strike so we know exactly how to react to it.
Which makes total sense.
Yeah.
But today we're looking at a piece of art that takes that deep-seated biological instinct and just, well, totally short-circuits it.
It really does.
So for this deep dive, we were exploring the private diaries of artist Jarrod Duque, specifically looking at his watercolor painting Cyrano, which is painting number 6 in a series.
And our mission today is to figure out how we engineered a predator that terrifies and awes you by doing essentially nothing at all.
It's such a fascinating inversion. He takes all of that latent biological force, all of that inherent danger, and intentionally compresses it into this atmosphere of profound, almost sepulchral silence.
And what makes this deep dive so unique is that we aren't just looking at the finished canvas hanging on a gallery wall.
No, we have rare access to Duque's private diary, this document titled Trastio Pintura Artistica.
Which is huge. That kind of access really changes the game. I mean, historically, art is presented to the public as this locked puzzle inside a frame. The creator steps away, and the critics and the public are just left to guess the original intention.
You're just kind of flying blind.
Exactly. So to have the creator voluntarily expose his rawest mental processes, his nagging doubts, and his hyper-specific technical decisions, it allows us to dissect exactly how the physical construction of the artwork and the artist's own psychological evolution merged to create this masterpiece.
Well, I want to start right at the foundation of that physical construction. Because right out of the gate, I'm seeing this fundamental structural contradiction.
You mean the medium?
Yes, the medium Duque chose for this piece is watercolor. Now, when I think of watercolor, I think of light, fluid, ethereal landscapes.
Soft washes, yeah.
Right. It is, by definition, tinted water. So if the goal is to paint an imposing, light-absorbing, incredibly dense, dark feline, isn't using watercolor a complete contradiction? It feels like he's picking the absolute weakest tool for the heaviest possible job.
It definitely seems super counterintuitive. If you want a heavy, dark presence on a canvas, you typically reach for oil paints, right? Or thick sculptural
Right,
acrylics.
something with some physical weight to it.
Exactly. Watercolor is notoriously unforgiving and delicate. But this apparent paradox is actually precisely where the engineering genius of Cyrano begins.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Well, to understand the emotional weight of this feline, we first have to understand the literal physical weight of the materials used to construct it. Duque didn't just grab a standard sketchbook from a craft store. He made highly specific engineering decisions to solve this exact structural problem.
And his notes in the diary break down those exact specifications, which is just amazing to read.
They do. He specifies the use of French arches paper, but not just any sheet. He chose a 640-gram cold-pressed coarse grain paper.
And he worked on a pretty large format too, right?
Yeah, a massive 22 by 30-inch format. Coupled with that, he used Daniel Smith pigments, which are just legendary among painters for their extreme color saturation and pigment density.
I think we really need to contextualize that 640-gram paper for a second.
Yeah.
Because if you aren't a practicing painter, that just sounds like a meaningless stationary stat.
True, it's hard to visualize.
So think of it this way.
Yeah.
A standard 300-gram watercolor paper is basically like a lightweight cotton t-shirt. If you get caught in a rainstorm wearing that, the shirt gets completely soaked, it clings to you, it loses all its shape.
It just buckles under the water.
Exactly. You look slightly ridiculous. But this 640-gram paper, that is like a heavy-duty, weatherproof winter parka. You could probably survive a hurricane in this paper.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. It is structurally engineered to take an intense punishment of water and heavy pigment without warping. It maintains total integrity.
But it isn't just about the thickness, right? The texture plays a massive role too.
Oh, absolutely. You mentioned it's cold pressed and coarse grain. If you were to slide a piece of that specific paper under a microscope, you wouldn't see a flat, smooth surface at all.
What would you see?
You would see an aggressive landscape. It's this wild topography of microscopic mountains and deep valleys made entirely of cellulose fibers.
So why does that microscopic landscape actually matter when you're trying to paint a dark cat? Like, practically speaking.
It all comes down to the physics of those Daniel Smith pigments. The sheer density of the black paint required to render this feline is just staggering.
Because it's so dark.
Right. So if you were to drop that much heavy ink onto a smooth, flat surface like, say, a piece of standard printer paper, the paint essentially suffocates.
Suffocates.
Yeah, it pools together, it dries completely flat, and it reflects light in a way that just looks dead, like a flat black hole.
Oh, I see.
But when you apply that same heavy wash to the coarse grain of the Arches paper, those heavy pigment particles fall into and get trapped in the microscopic valleys.
While the peaks stay exposed.
Exactly. Okay. The peaks of the cellulose mountains stay slightly exposed, catching these tiny, imperceptible fragments of light.
Wow. So the texture of the paper is literally holding the darkness, but giving it microscopic breathing room.
Exactly. It traps the heavy black pigment, but prevents the visual suffocation of the ink. It keeps the darkness looking rich and dimensional rather than flat and lifeless.
Which is so crucial, because this ink wasn't going to stay in the safety of his studio forever. He basically built a physically indestructible painting.
Which is ironic, considering what happened next.
Right. Considering that just a month later, he shipped it into one of the most psychologically fragile environments imaginable.
The geographic and psychological jump this piece made is just intense.
If we track the timeline in Dutz's diary, Serena was completed in July of 2024 in his private studio in Whittier, California.
And a private studio is this intimately chaotic bubble of total control. It's an incubator.
Yeah, if a breaststroke goes terribly wrong, no one sees it.
Exactly. The artist dictates the lighting, the mood, the music playing in the background. But then, just 1 month later, in August 2024, Serino is boxed up, put on a plane, and shipped across the Atlantic.
To the Art Box Size Art Expo in Zurich, Switzerland. That is quite the commute.
Passing from the protective room of that Whittier studio to the glaring lights of a major European art fair, I mean, that is a terrifying leap for any creator.
So let's step into the shoes of an art critic walking the floor in Zurich for a second.
Okay, so when a piece leaves the safety of the studio, the artist is no longer standing next to it to defend it. Duke isn't there to explain the mood he was going for or to, you know, contextualize a slightly awkward shadow.
Or to tell you how hard he worked on it. The painting is completely naked in the room. It has to speak for itself.
It does. The critic in Zurich doesn't care about the artist's late night struggles in California. They have hundreds of pieces to evaluate.
Right. They're just moving from one canvas to the next.
Exactly. They only care about what is successfully communicating on the paper directly in front of them. The piece is under an incredibly unforgiving lens.
So what does that actually mean for the artwork itself?
It demands that the artwork possess an unshakable conceptual solidity. The emotional intention behind the painting has to be as robust and structurally sound as that heavy 640-gram paper it's painted on. Otherwise, it just crumbles under mass scrutiny.
And you can really feel that pressure in Duke's diary. To ensure the painting could survive that cold Swiss scrutiny, he essentially beat the critics to the punch.
Oh, absolutely.
You read this journal, and here's where it gets really interesting. It's basically an autopsy of a masterpiece by the person who just birthed it.
Yes, the level of self-scrutiny is wild.
He starts by acknowledging what he knows he got right. He praises his own formal synthesis. Like, he notes that the way the dark body of the feline drapes across the wooden branch creates this really powerful compositional spine for the entire piece.
It anchors the visual weight perfectly. The viewer's eye is immediately grounded. But what's remarkable is that he doesn't just pat himself on the back and move on.
No, not at all.
He immediately pivots to dissecting his perceived flaws.
Which takes a really profound level of humility. He gets highly critical of his own use of color. He writes that he wishes he had risked more in modulating the blacks.
Right.
And I have to admit, reading that, I had a moment of pure confusion. I'm thinking, wait, isn't black just black? You squeeze the tube, black paint comes out, you paint the panther. What on earth is there to modulate?
That assumption right there is the ultimate visual trap. And it's exactly what separates an amateur from a master.
Tell me more about that.
If you just take black paint straight from the tube and slather it flat onto the paper, you don't create a creature. You create a cartoon silhouette. It just becomes a dead hole on the paper.
Oh, wow. So you're saying if you just use pure black, it would look like a literal void.
Yeah.
So to fix that, he's actually hiding other colors inside the black.
Exactly. That's what modulating the black means. You breathe life into the void by injecting these subtle temperature variations into the darkness.
Temperature variations.
Yeah.
Like warm and cold.
Right. A master doesn't just use black. They mix in ultramarine blue to create cold, receding shadows in the deepest parts of the fur. Then, on the edges where the ambient nightlight might hit, they mix in a toasted brown to create a warm, approaching edge.
Even though the overall red to my eye is just, quote-unquote, black.
Precisely. Your conscious eye sees a black panther, but your brain registers those tiny temperature shifts, the cold blues and the warm browns.
That is wild.
And subconsciously, your brain understands that there is a living, breathing, warm-blooded biological mass beneath that dense fur. It stops being a flat shape and becomes a living body.
That is absolutely fascinating. He's layering temperatures to fake a body heat.
Yes, and the diary shows he didn't stop his self-critique at the cat either. He also targeted the environment.
Right, the branch in the background.
Yeah.
He noted that he wanted to better integrate the wooden branch the cat is resting on with the starry night background.
Yeah, he felt the separation between the physical wood of the branch and the ethereal sky was slightly too rigid.
Too harsh of a line.
Exactly. He thought the boundary was almost too graphic, kind of like a cardboard cutout. He writes about how he should have utilized softer, more blurred edges.
Letting the darkness of the wood bleed organically into the darkness of the sky?
Right, rather than maintaining a hard separating line, it's all about unity.
It really makes you rethink what mastery actually is. You'd think an artist shipping his work to a major Swiss expo would just put his brush down, pour a drink, and say, perfect, I'm a genius.
Yeah. But instead, he's looking at it under a microscope, obsessing over blurred edges and the temperature of his shadows.
Exactly. True mastery isn't a finish line where you just stop learning. It is this continuous, honestly kind of agonizing process of observation and brutal humility.
And all of this meticulous self-critique, the obsessive engineering with the heavy paper, the dense pigments, the temperature of the shadows, it all serves one very specific emotional goal.
What's that?
Well, he isn't just trying to paint an accurate picture of a cat. He is trying to engineer an atmosphere that physically affects the viewer standing in front of it.
And he actually coins a very specific term for that atmosphere in his diary. He calls the vibe of the painting quietu tensa, which translates to tense quiet.
Which is such a brilliant concept.
But it's a total oxymoron. Tense and quiet usually oppose each other.
It is an oxymoron, but it captures the psychology of the piece flawlessly. I mean, think about it. This isn't a passive rest. The cat isn't sleepily lounging like a golden retriever in a sunbeam.
Right, it's not taking a nap.
It is the pure manifestation of dominance. It is an apex predator so completely secure in its own power that it doesn't need to display the attitude of an imminent attack.
But it also doesn't show the slightest hint of retreat. Mm. It's just present.
Yeah.
It occupies the space.
Completely.
And reading how he constructed the background to support that presence brought up this amazing analogy for me. It's exactly like a master symphony composer.
Oh, how so?
When a composer wants to make the most devastatingly powerful note in the entire symphony hit you right in the chest, they don't just play it louder. What do they do right before that note?
They pause.
Exactly. They give the audience absolute dead silence. Because the silence is what gives the note its contrast and its incredible power. You feel the silence physically in a concert hall.
That is a phenomenal comparison. And Duke does the exact same thing visually.
Like the sky, right?
Yes. He uses these warm glazes, these very thin, highly translucent layers of paint, and creates low-intensity, quiet zones in the vast night sky. He is literally painting visual silence.
So that massive expanse of quiet sky is what gives the incredibly dense, heavy figure of the feline the room to just breathe and resonate with the viewer.
Exactly. If the background was busy or chaotic or, you know, full of bright glowing stars, the cat would lose all of its imposing power. That visual silence is a structural requirement for the painting to actually work.
And he reinforces that feeling of suspended time with the inclusion of the moon in the background, too.
It's important to note that the moon isn't acting like a harsh spotlight, though. It's not illuminating the cat like an actor on a stage.
It's more symbolic.
Very much so. It's a non-dominating light source that just hangs there in the quietude tensa, suspending time. It freezes this one prolonged moment of observation.
And all of that, the heavy topography of the paper, the warm and cool modulated blacks, the vast silent sky, the suspended moon, it all acts as a funnel.
Directing your gaze.
Exactly. It directs your attention down to one single microscopic point of contact, the eyes of the feline.
Which, ironically, are barely accentuated at all. They aren't glowing yellow, they aren't painted with hyper-realistic detail, but they are undeniably the psychological anchor of the entire painting.
When you look at those barely there eyes, you experience this really jarring psychological shift. You realize the animal isn't just sitting there being looked at.
It is evaluating you.
Yes, it is looking back. It knows exactly where you are standing, it knows exactly what you are, and it deliberately chooses not to react. It doesn't need to bare its fangs or roar because it knows you aren't a threat.
That is the very essence of tense quiet. And I think this raises a profound point, something that honestly transcends art criticism and hits right at the core of how we live our daily lives.
I was just thinking the exact same thing. Because if you contrast the mood of this painting with the world you and I live in right now, the difference is just staggering.
Oh, completely.
We live in this hyper-connected, information-saturated society. We are practically addicted to social drama and constant stimulation.
Yeah.
We have this pervasive, exhausting anxiety that we must constantly make noise.
We really do. We have to post our opinions, show our force, document our meals.
Right. And be in a state of constant visible action just to validate that we even exist.
We constantly equate volume with value. If you weren't screaming into the void of the internet, do you even matter? That's the modern condition. We confuse making noise with having power.
But Cirino serves as a masterclass in the exact opposite philosophy.
It really does. True power, deep security, and absolute confidence rarely need to be loud. They don't need to perform for a digital audience or prove their relevance every 5 minutes.
They choose to dress in silence.
The apex predator doesn't need to roar to prove it owns the jungle.
Wow. So let's take a step back and look at the incredible journey of Cirino that we've charted today. It starts at the microscopic level, with this robust, heavy-duty, 640-gram Arches paper, specifically engineered with peaks and valleys to trap those incredibly dense Daniel Smith pigments.
And then it survives that brave, solitary journey from the intimate safety of a studio in Whittier, California, to face the cold, unforgiving scrutiny of the international art market in Zurich.
Exactly. It withstands the brutal, brilliant self-critique of its own creator. A master who is constantly pushing himself to hide body heat in the shadows and blur the rigid lines of reality.
And the culmination of all that material engineering and psychological evolution is a total masterpiece of tense quiet, a piece of art that brilliantly neutralizes our primal expectation for violence and replaces it with the awe of silent dominance.
Which leaves you with one final lingering thought to mull over today as you step back out into the noise of the real world. We started this deep dive by talking about the explosive action and chaos we inherently expect from an apex predator. But if that same predator can command total respect and project undeniable authority through nothing but a silent presence and an enviable economy of gestures, how might you apply that same tense quiet to your own daily human interactions? The next time you feel the pressure to immediately react to an email, or to shout your opinion into the void, or to prove your worth in a society that constantly confuses making noise with holding true power, what would happen if you chose, instead, the sepulchral silence of the feline?